And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. Who says an Ivy League education isn't affordable? These days, if you have a computer, you can take courses in everything from algorithms to astrobiology and nanotechnology to nutrition. It's part of a movement by major universities and colleges to reach a much larger audience and to make high-quality courses available to people who might not otherwise make it to Harvard or Penn or Duke or MIT. So the good news is lots of people can take free online courses from some of the finest universities in the world. There are some, however, who would argue that the bad news is lots of people can take free online courses from some of the finest universities in the world. So is this concept the wave of the future? Could it become a viable way to circumvent six-figure college tuition? Or is it a Pandora's box that could ultimately thwart the purpose of higher education? We'll hear from a University of Virginia professor who is sounding a warning about these offerings, but we begin with a look at what these courses offer, who benefits, and how they're still very much evolving. Joining us is the co-founder of Coursera, one of the online education companies that offers free online classes. Andrew Ng is a professor of computer science at Stanford. Andrew, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, Tracy. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you. And also with us is Jeff Young, and Jeff is technology editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's also co-author of the Chronicle's new e-book, Rebooting the Academy, 12 Tech Innovators Who Are Transforming Campuses. Jeff, welcome to Radio Times.
Good to join you.
Well, glad to have both of you with us. Jeff, how long have major universities been offering these kinds of courses? Is this fairly new?
Well, in this form, as you say, the free and open and using and sort of from these world-class universities that are elite and hard to get into, this is a pretty new phenomenon. You can say that the start of the idea came maybe 10 years ago when MIT started opening some of their materials for free online, but really all they were doing was sort of, shoveling out things that were already prepared, lecture notes, and a lot of it was text. And it was really only in the last year couple years that a few people tried this idea of what if we take more of the material and actually make it a more interactive experience using videos and interactive quizzes and even involving peer learning online so that people out there on the web can actually help each other and make it more of a course instead of just kind of having some static material out there. It's a pretty new idea, and some say that it's really the technology that's allowed it now that video is, mainstream online and that some of these interactive platforms are more mature.
Hmm. So, Andrew, what kinds of courses? I mean, we cited a couple of them, but it sounds like there really is quite a wide variety even now. And sort of begs the question, can people get credit for these classes, or is it just sort of auditing them, or how does it work?
So today, the classes aren't good for academic credit at the universities, but from universities like Princeton, Penn, Stanford, Caltech, you can now sign up for classes on any of a broad range of disciplines. So if you want to take a humanities class or a finance class or a business class or a computer science class or a sociology class, you can do all of those online for free and really learn from the best professors at the best universities. And I agree with what Jeff said. I think, the thing that's really changed compared to what universities like Stanford and MIT were doing a decade ago is that these are real courses. So as a student, you sign on and every week you would watch lectures and every week you would do homework. I think we realized that students learn best not by passively listening to video, which is what we had, a decade ago, but by practicing with the material. And the new courses are real courses and have homework and a classroom and then classmates to discuss it with. And it gives you students the opportunities to practice with the material.
So it can take learning to another dimension, it sounds like.
I think so. And the thing, one thing that excites me is that this opens up a high-quality education to anyone in the world for free. And in addition, and maybe equally important, is that many of the universities working with Coursera are also using these technologies to improve the quality of education for their local on-campus students as well.
Well, Andrew, you mentioned the universities, and I'm wondering what's in it for them. I mean, these are, top-of-the-line universities, world-class. They're offering an enormous variety of their courses online for free. What's their incentive to do that?
I think there are two incentives. One is the outreach mission. If you're a Princeton professor, you probably care a lot about what you do, and when offered the technology to teach not just 50 students but 50,000 students, the answer is often an enthusiastic yes. The second motivation really is, I think, that it allows them to improve the quality of education for the local on-campus students as well. I think what you said earlier, you know, I've often been asked, if we're putting these courses online, why would anyone still pay $200,000 like a Princeton or a Penn or a Stanford or Caltech degree? And I think the answer is that the real value of a Princeton education is not just the content. Content is increasingly for free on the web anyway. Instead, the real value of attending Princeton is the opportunity to interact with the professors and with other equally bright students. So what we're seeing at these universities is that by putting the videos online, they can ask their own local on-campus students to watch the videos online, and this actually creates more classroom time for the interactions with the professors that I think is the real value of attending a top university in person.
And so that's the notion of the flipping the classroom, is that right? Where you can sort of spend the class time on more interactive activity and maybe do more of a deep dive, and then you have the video as another piece of it?
You're absolutely right. So the term flip classroom, it refers to the idea that rather than getting the lectures in the classroom and then doing the homework at home, you reverse that. So you do the homework at home, and you basically you get the lectures at home on video, and then you basically do the homework in the classroom with your classmates or the professors and have more lively discussions with the professors.
So, Jeff, I'm wondering, with the people who are taking advantage of this, since so many of these are not for credit, at least not now, do you see them at some point being offered for credit? And in the meantime, is it more of a personal enrichment kind of thing for people who are not on college campuses right now?
I think that is one of the really big questions, and you'll see, and Andrew can talk more about this, but there are a lot of the people trying these massive courses are going to offer certificates, so that even though you do not get a Stanford degree or credit, they are sort of, if you pass the class, going to give you you can download a PDF of a certificate that says, I passed the class in, artificial intelligence or search engine, optimization. And then the question becomes, down the line, will employers see those certificates as valuable or not? And for some people, maybe people already in their careers and not in a position where they want to go back to school, but just need some skills they could use this, or perhaps it could even be a thought of as a replacement, but I mean, that's definitely down the road, if at all, because right now the diploma is really the gold standard. I mean, that's what employers look for, and it's almost hard to imagine in some ways that a certificate printed online will be equivalent.
Although there is something nice about a certificate that says Princeton or MIT or Harvard, isn't there?
Well, the language, it's interesting in the contract that Coursera signed with folks, which we got under a Freedom of Information Act request out of Michigan, but they have very specific language, and maybe Andrew could talk about this, about the way the wording would be, because it is an interesting line you're walking. It's not a Stanford course or a Michigan course, but it is a professor at Michigan, and Michigan is sort of working with the company. So there's specific language I think they're still trying to work out of how that would read.
Well, Andrew, lots of things are indeed still being worked out. And I'm curious, how does a company like yours, like Coursera, which is one of a handful that are coordinating with these universities to offer these classes online, how do you make money from this?
So we're exploring several possibilities, but one that I'm excited about is placement services. So to your point and Jeff's, many employers have actually contacted us asking if they can hire our top students, because it turns out that someone, does well in a Penn class or does well in a Princeton class, that's a very strong sign that they're very talented students that many employers would love to hire. So we've been working on this placement service where if a student gives us permission or requests that we introduce them to employers, we'll do so. And this seems like something that employers would likely be willing to pay for. We've also been talking to our partners about maybe charging for some of the certificates. The wording actually varies a bit by university, but many universities, like Penn, if someone takes a Penn class and gets a University of Pennsylvania certificate, that seems like it might be worth something. And once again, at least anecdotally, even the very informal PDF files we've been sending to people so far, that we've been seeing many students proudly list them in their resume and successfully use them to get a better job.
So it sounds like this is very much a work in progress in terms of identifying those revenue streams that could really make this profitable for a company like yours, where sort of everybody wins, the university, the students, and companies like Coursera.
Yeah, I think the current ethos in Silicon Valley is that if you're changing millions of people's lives, there'll be plenty of ways to bring in revenue and keep it sustainable. And so right now we're really focused on building out the platform and giving, we have 111 courses, you know, across 16 universities that we're offering for free. So building that out has been our focus. And then I think bringing in the revenue is something that we can take our time to build out.
And Andrew, what about professors? Have any of them approached you and said, well, wait a minute, we should be getting royalties from this? I mean, would professors conceivably be paid for their content, their intellectual property?
So we would like to share revenue back with the universities and the professors creating this content. And our agreement with the universities is that if and when, you know, we generate revenue, it will be shared back with the university. That will often share it with the professor too, so although it's up to them. But I think really the professors that have been coming to us have been motivated much more by, I think, the outreach, and there's been, I feel like, you know, almost no discussion of money. I mean, it turns out, you know, if you're a University of Pennsylvania medical school professor, if you've invented some new life-saving technology, are you more, really, the faculty we've been talking to, much more motivated by the prospect of teaching those technologies to tens of thousands of people and saving a lot of people's lives, literally in this case, rather than, you know, making money, although we want to make sure that happens too.
Hmm. Well, Andrew, I know we don't have you with us for much longer, but I want to ask, do you think that at some point, 20, 30, 50 years down the road, that this whole concept could make a dramatic change, I mean, really be a game changer for higher education?
I think it is. My belief is that this will be a game changer for higher education. Today, because of reasons of finances or geography or time, most people will just never have access to a Princeton class or a Penn class or a Caltech class. But thanks to technology, if you wake up tomorrow morning and you feel like taking a Princeton class, you can now sign up for one for free. And I think the ability to offer a free, high-quality education to anyone in the world, I think that can really improve a lot of people's lives, and that's what we're out to do at Coursera.
And I heard, too, that is there a possibility of even working with community colleges with some of this content?
Yeah, so we've been approached by a number of universities that have been interested in using our content. Earlier, you asked if it's possible to get academic credit. So if you take a free online Princeton class, it's not good for academic credit towards a Princeton degree. But what we're seeing is that a number of other universities have been sending their students to us to take our classes online, telling the students to bring back a certificate, and then they get credit towards the degree. So we've been approached by a number of schools. We had nothing to do with this, but I think this is a great thing for the students.
Well, Andrew Ng, thank you so much for being with us, co-founder of Coursera, and we wish you the best with that. We appreciate your sharing your time with us.
Thanks.
So we're talking about these online offerings from major universities and colleges for free. Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Where is it all leading? We will talk about those courses and more when Radio Times comes back.
Penn supports WHYY. Do you frequently walk into a room and immediately forget why? Do you need to write things down to remember them? Is multitasking getting harder? If so, you may qualify for a research study focusing on memory in menopausal women. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness is seeking women between the ages of 45 and 60 and within 5 years of their last menstrual cycle to participate in research to study the effects of certain hormones and medication on cognition in peri- and postmenopausal women. 215-41-STUDY.
Although you can use it to scrub pots and pans, few gardeners sing the praises of the weed known as horsetail. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a close look at this ancient and unusual plant. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
A Olympic athlete Tamua Anai isn't as well known as swimmer Michael Phelps, but when she's in the pool as a goalkeeper for the U.S. women's water polo team, all eyes are on her.
Goaling takes a lot of mental strength. I mean, you're either the hero or the zero. You either block the shot or you don't.
We continue our conversations with Olympic athletes next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and perhaps you have heard about these online courses that some of the major universities and colleges are offering to anyone who's got a computer. You can sign up for all manner of courses. They are free, and they're courses from schools like MIT, Harvard, Penn, Duke, all kinds of really top-line universities are offering some really interesting courses that people can take for free. And we're talking about how does that work? Is it something that could really be a game changer for higher education? Where is it all going? And lots of questions remain, as it is still very much a work in progress. But we are talking with Jeff Young, and Jeff is technology editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's co-editor of the Chronicle's new ebook, Rebooting the Academy, 12 Tech Innovators Who Are Transforming Campuses. Jeff, in a moment, we're going to hear from a UVA professor who has some questions about how this is all going to pan out, and we'll welcome him in just a few minutes. But let me welcome our listeners and invite you to call in with your questions. Maybe you're taking one of these courses, or you're considering taking one of these courses, or you're wondering if perhaps you could save some money on that six-figure college tuition through these courses. At any rate, the number is 888-477-9499. Jeff Young, I want to pick up with a question that I asked Andrew before the break, and that was, do you think it is possible, or will it ever be possible, to get a full college education online for free, or for far less than a typical Ivy League education might cost?
I think that is a really interesting and exciting question as we watch these free courses, you know, first get started. And of course, there's going to be the question of how effective they are, and that's one issue. But I think one of the questions that really comes up here is what is the product of a university? You know, when you do sign up for Penn or Princeton, you in some ways we all think of it as the sitting in the classroom and the big lecture hall, and it's kind of beautiful architecture around you, and you're with the students and you're learning. But there's so much more, obviously, to a campus, and the question of, and even the courses you pick. If you look at the courses at Coursera and other these upstarts, they're primarily been, the first ones are usually computer science or engineering, very skills-based in some ways. I mean, these are very complicated topics that I certainly haven't mastered, but they're ones that you can test in multiple choice in some ways, or have programs that a computer program can kind of check, did the program, is it coded correctly? I think it gets more complicated when you think of the broad liberal arts or general education at universities, where there might be, of course, the English course that any college student takes, or the composition writing classes, the poetry, the kind of cultural history. And are those going to work in this model if the business model turns out to be employment matching, as Andrew suggested as one of the ideas? Are employers going to be interested in those broad liberal arts courses that colleges are really known for? And so will they, you know, will those courses also go in these free models, or will it be a real sort of subsect of colleges? And so will the whole courses ever be out there, I think, is part of the question.
Yeah. And how about grading? How does that work? Either for someone who is sort of, let's say, auditing the course, right? They're not getting credit. But when these assignments are given, how does the grading process work, in theory at least?
Sure. And you mentioned how much of a work in progress this is. The Coursera folks have told me they're excited about the idea of peer grading, which you can find this at some traditional universities, although it's a minority idea right now, that, you know, if you have, say, a writing assignment, you match up the students and they grade each other's work, and then maybe there's a TA or somebody looking over, spot-checking some of these to see if they are up to what's being taught. But the idea is, online, can you use the crowd? You know, there's all this, you know, crowdsourcing and wisdom of the crowd. Can the crowd help teach each other, even if some of them have just learned it themselves? And there's a lot of excitement around that idea.
So it's like the sort of Wikipedia mentality or even the Twitter that, you know, you can sort of form these groups of people who are knowledgeable, who, you know, can get together and sort of sharpen each other, I guess.
That's what I'm hearing, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Cheating is another question that's been raised about all of this and how that gets managed, because I would think it would be pretty easy to slide somebody who knows a lot more about the subject, you know, in front of your laptop and have them take the final for you.
Yeah, I mean, you can sort of imagine how easy it might be for a clever 19-year-old or actually someone of any age to sort of try to game the system, especially if something is on the line. If these certificates become, you know, a coin of the realm in getting a job, then there will be an incentive for cheating. And I think right now there are a lot of questions. There are some experiments, especially around EdX, which you mentioned that Harvard and MIT are among those doing this. And so some are working on their own to create, instead of working with a company like Coursera, they're kind of creating their own nonprofit to deliver these types of courses. And that there's one called EdX. And they tell me that one of the part of the project is to make it a research project. And one of the questions for their researchers is, can we do with technology a way to cheaply verify that people are who they say they are? And this is, it almost gets into James Bond kind of stuff, of not quite a retina scan, but, you know, they tell me that they can even potentially use the keystroke pattern or style of typing of a student.
Oh, wow.
To see if, now this is apparently in the research stage, but, you know, maybe the way I type is different than the way you type, and that if I type on day one and say I'm me, and some, all of a sudden the typing style changes, the computer could be flagging that and saying, no, wait a minute, or, who is this?
Well, as long as it's not the right person who's just sort of having a bad day or just not
Yeah, you got a cold. I don't know. Yeah, it's. I think, you know, that is not out there in real life yet.
Yeah, well, it sounds like the, you know, the possibilities are really interesting as to how that's going to, how it's going to sort of play out. I'm interested too, Jeff, what's the difference? I mean, online courses are not new, right?
But
what's the difference between something like this and, say, what University of Phoenix offers?
And some, you know, mainstream universities too. And that's a great question, and a lot of people are sort of, just if you're looking from the outside, it's, wait, what's different? I think the traditional model, and this happens a lot with technology, right? When we first do something and there's the internet, well, you just keep doing the exact same way you've been doing it, and you just try to use the internet. And so I think a lot of the early distance learning courses were very much trying to just copy the classroom model of lecture delivery, and then maybe have a test once a week or a quiz once a week and then a final at the end. I think what you're seeing now with these open courses is they're trying to sort of say, well, why do we have to do it that way? And one of the big innovations, if you will, has been, for instance, you know, the lectures that most of us sat through in college were about an hour. And that, if you're on the internet, why is that? A lot of the early open, you know, online courses are, they kind of do it in an hour type of online lecture or an hour's worth of material, but now people are dicing it up into very small chunks. And so maybe 10 minutes is a time that a lot of people are trying. And then after 10 minutes, every 10-minute video you watch, you might take a quick quiz to see if you actually got it, and if not, well, watch it again or watch a different video. And so instead of this idea that, you know, once a week or twice a week you get an hour's worth of, you know, info dump, and then you have to do some stuff. It's the idea of how do you make an interactive kind of experience on the web that takes advantage of the fact that no one's sitting in a classroom.
Yeah. Jeff, is this possibly a disruptive technology of some sort?
Well, that's a big buzzword out there, and one reason we're covering this so much is that our readers are very interested in whether they could. A lot of administrators are seeing this as a way to really shake things up, and so I think it's hard to predict, but I think the interesting idea here is that technology's been at college classrooms. You know, if you visit a campus, it's very high tech. The classrooms are loaded with technology. There's wireless all over campus at a lot of places. But if you look at, if you walk into a you know, Econ 101 or any kind of introductory class, you'll see lecture style that's pretty much the same way it's been done, you know, for, you could argue, for, you know, hundreds of years, with now just some PowerPoint making the slides appear clearer. And so the model hasn't really changed. And so a lot of university administrators are kind of excited that the professors are excited about this idea, because then maybe if professors try this new technique, they might bring that back to their own courses, and it might actually bring a change that hasn't happened as far as a real shift, a kind of a rethinking of teaching on campus. And so that might be end up being one of the ways this works out.
Well, let me invite our listeners to join us in this conversation. We are talking about these online courses that are being offered by some of the major universities and colleges in the United States. They're free, and there's an enormous variety, everything from nutrition to algorithms. I mean, you name it, it's probably there. And we're talking about ultimately, what does that mean for higher education? Is it something that's going to enhance it, or is it something that's going to sort of thwart the purpose of higher education? Not everyone is totally on board with this idea, and at this point we want to welcome a guest to our program. We want to talk with a professor from the University of Virginia. Siva Vaidyanathan is with us, and he is a chair of the Media Studies Department at the University of Virginia. He also teaches in the School of Law and is the author of The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Siva, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, Tracy. Thanks very much.
So do you see this as maybe a Pandora's box of some type?
No, it's not a Pandora's box, and it's not a game changer, and it's not disruptive. It is interesting. The number one thing I think we should all remember when we discuss these experiments is that we need to get past the hyperbole. What is happening here is that a small number of universities, soon to be a large number of universities, are slowly and steadily inviting faculty to upload course material and play around with different methods of interacting with students for the sake of figuring out what might work and what doesn't work, and for the sake of, let's be frank, advertising, right? This is a grand marketing experiment. At this point, we're talking about show business. We are not talking about education. There is a huge gap between what is happening in 2012 through these massive open online courses and what we actually do in the classroom. There are certain elements of the classroom that we can simulate. There are certain elements of the classroom that we're not close to simulating. Jeff's right in the sense that, you know, we are liberated from the grid of the classroom schedule. But all we've seen so far is a pandering to the incentives of show business, which means dumbing down material in some cases. It means breaking up lectures into discernible pieces that appeal to a wider audience and not necessarily the audience that you would expect in a Princeton computer science classroom. And that may not be bad. That actually could be really good, but it's not the same.
Are you concerned about a dumbing down of the quality?
I am if the incentives stay as they are. And the incentives right now are geared toward being able to brag about the thousands of people or hundreds of thousands of people who enroll up front in one of these distributions. And that has nothing to do with whether any of those people actually complete the assignments or whether they learn anything from the assignments or whether they're able to deploy any of that material afterwards. So all of those things are things that are challenges that people are working on. This is what we have to remember. The actual work going on here, the work going on by the people who are running Coursera, the people who are actually launching these efforts, the faculty launching these efforts, that's all very sincere. But it is not revolutionary. It is about trying to figure out a variety of different tactics and tools that might make us better teachers, that might do, if nothing else, inspire students, right? But there's a huge difference between inspiration and education. And I think what we're looking at right now is a really exciting ability to inspire students or inspire potential students into exploring deeper into some material. Let's be frank. We're talking about, at this point, a bunch of introductory courses. Some of them are rather complex, right? I mean, some of them are certainly beyond my ability to follow. But we are talking about a catalog more than anything. And we're talking about a collection of course content that is essentially taking the worst things that we do in the classroom and putting it up in an online environment, right? So we're not doing the best things we do in the classroom, which is improvisation, interpreting the moment, reacting to the day's events. Those sorts of things, at this point, we are nowhere near capturing. Now, I say that as someone who has taught online courses through the University of Maryland, University College before, and I had a really good live experience teaching two classes on copyright to professional librarians. And in those situations, we had complete interactivity. I was dealing with students from California, from Illinois, from Baltimore in real time, and I was having a tremendous amount of rich interactivity with them. They all read the material I assigned beforehand. We got together for an hour. I had my slides up visible in their windows, and I talked over them, and I was able to see their comments and questions. Now, it's not as great as if I could have flown all of those people into a room for that period of time, but there's give and take in that, right? I lose a little, but I gain a tremendous amount of convenience, and they do more than anything. So there are all sorts of cool things that we're doing with technology. I really have to take issue with what Jeff said about how, you know, we haven't been moving in different ways in the classroom. There's absolutely no truth to that. Everybody who teaches at the university level has been pushing, experimenting, changing what we do in the classroom as long as we've been teaching. There's nothing static about that practice, and I think that, and Jeff knows that because he's been in enough classrooms to know that there's no way that a lecture in 2012 looks or feels anything like a lecture in 1982.
Well, Steve, let me stop you there because I want to give Jeff an opportunity to respond to that because you have raised some red flags and some concerns here. Jeff?
Well, and Siva, and I certainly have seen a lot of great teaching, and I write a lot of features where I am seeing the cutting-edge, state-of-the-art attempts. And so I didn't mean to suggest that there are no experiments. I guess I was really reflecting on the model, and to clarify, you know, I mean the lecture model. And so obviously I was contrasting that with the idea of, you know, breaking this up into 10-minute chunks instead of an hour. And I guess that's what I mean, is that these new upstarts are attempting to really kind of rethink it from the total ground up, and instead of the hour meeting twice a week. And some of those things are, or once a week, or 3-hour, you know, once a week. And I think those are structural things that are not just the professors doing. And so, and this is not necessarily to, I think the interesting thing too is that a lot of the things that are going on campuses are not, it's not the fault of professors or even a criticism at all. It's more of a comment on the system that's been, and the system of incentives for teaching. And a lot of the teaching experiments that are going on are because the professors just love it and want to do it.
Right.
Because, not because they're getting rewarded professionally. And so,
But actually we are. We get tremendously rewarded, and we have for my entire career, for doing experiments in the classroom, for bringing in digital materials, for bringing in digital tools. I mean, I can speak from my own experience, and every institution I've ever spoken to, there was a tremendous amount of money out there, tremendous amount of money wasted as well, on doing those sort of digital innovations, the very things you've been writing about for years. So it's not true that the incentives don't favor those sorts of experimentations,
I guess,
and collaborations.
But would you say that there is a, you know, has there been a widespread revolution? I guess the, you know, in the classroom.
Oh no, because
teaching?
there's no call for a widespread revolution. Nor should any responsible person say that that's what's happening. You know, what we're trying is to do better things with the resources we have, resources that are constantly squeezed, with students who are in flux, individually and collectively, with materials and subject matter that's in flux. I mean, teaching
Siva,
biology
I want to stop you
today,
right there, because we actually have to take a quick break, but please hold that thought. We are talking about the online offerings from some of the major universities and colleges across America for free. What is the net effect of that? We'd love to hear your comments as well, and we'll go to the phones too when we come right back.
Teachers from grades 7 through 12 can take their classroom skills to the next digital level. WHYY through American Graduate is now offering scholarships for teachers to attend a special course, Visual Storytelling Basics for the Classroom, at WHYY's Hamilton Commons. Learn firsthand how smartphones, still cameras, and simple free editing software can enhance your classroom and encourage students. Classes are November 3rd. Apply for your full scholarship now at whyy.org/americangraduate.
On the next Fresh Air, Christopher Bea talks about his new novel, What Happened to Sophie Wilder. It's in part about why some people have the capacity for faith and others do not. The character Sophie becomes a devout Catholic.
But that conversion doesn't necessarily lead to peace, doesn't end her struggle, but rather leads to a new struggle.
Join us this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann's claims that an aide to Hillary Clinton has relatives with ties to the Muslim Brotherhood and should be investigated is causing a split in the Republican Party. We'll dip in. Also, streaming the Olympics, what will we be able to watch on our TVs, computers, smartphones? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about MOOCs. If you haven't heard of that before, they are massive, open, online courses, and chances are you may have heard that many of the top universities in the United States are offering content for free, that if you have a computer, you can sign up and take a class in algorithms or poetry or nutrition or any number of things. And we're talking about the implications of those offerings. Could they, in fact, be a game changer for higher education or not? We're talking with Jeff Young. Jeff is technology editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's been covering this quite a bit. And we are also talking with Siva Vaidyanathan, who is chair of the Media Studies Department at the University of Virginia. He also teaches in the School of Law, and he's the author of The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Siva, I have to apologize. We had to take a break when you were in the middle of a thought there. I'm going to ask you to quickly finish your thought, and we have lots of calls we want to go to as well.
There's a tremendous amount of experimentation going on in every classroom at every university in the country right now. And it's not because we're pressured. It's actually because we care deeply about how we do things. And so, you know, often I hear from mostly the less informed advocates of MOOCs that they're somehow disrupting or shaking up a static system. That couldn't be farther from the truth. There's no more dynamic, creative place when you're talking about education than a major university. And that's been true throughout my career and before my career. But that said, look, let's remember that what we're seeing here are some really interesting experiments that are that have the potential to spread knowledge, at least in a modest form, to corners of the world which are not able to get access to some of the coolest stuff coming out of universities. So this is certainly something to celebrate, honor, and support. But let's not pretend that it is something it is not. Yeah.
Well, let's go to the phones, because there are lots of people who would like to speak with both of you about this. And we'll start off with Ron. Welcome, Ron, to Radio Times. All right, we will get to Ron in just a moment, but let's go to East Windsor. And Yanni, welcome, Yanni, to Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Yeah, so when I was in Rutgers about 2 years ago, my last semester of college was entirely online, and in total took about 12 courses, and they're probably the best experience of my college career. And one of the speakers was talking about how they don't provide the same classroom experience. I had classes where we were doing chat rooms, we were doing group projects that went better off than any group project they ever did in the classroom. We were more focused, that the education quality was much higher because the students were much more interested. It was much more by choice of taking the online course versus those students who would want to be in a normal classroom.
Well, thank you, Yanni, for sharing that with us. And Jeff, what do you think about that? It sounds like there's someone who's had a very positive experience.
Oh, absolutely. And the one that you know, Siva was talking about, I'm sure that was a wonderful experience for the students, too. I think the interesting thing, when you ask me what's new, I think the interesting experiment here is that Yanni's experience probably sounded like there was an instructor very much on hand and very attentive to probably a pretty small group of students paying tuition, whereas this new model, the question is, can it scale to 50,000 students? As Andrew pointed out, that they're trying to have kind of a ratio of one teacher for every 50,000 students by using kind of the crowd and auto grading and video lectures. And the question is, can the experience be as good in that kind of environment as what the caller here had in the way traditional universities have done online learning traditionally now, or for the last, you know, 10 years or more?
All right. We'll go next to Ron. Welcome, Ron, to Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I want to say I'm a proponent of online learning. I have my online master's degree through George Washington University, which was very good, and I paid for it. However, there's still a stigma out there, and I work in the education industry. There's still a stigma out in industry itself, from the old guard, so to speak, that online courses, online education, isn't as good as brick and mortar. Having just listened to the last caller, how their experience was good, and your answer was that, you know, that it was a few students in with one student as opposed to 50,000. How is that stigma going to be overcome in the industry with these online courses? I mean, what's the process that would have to happen?
Interesting question, Ron, and I'll put it to our guests to take a crack at it. Siva, would you like to take that question?
Well, so it's interesting that the caller expresses it as a stigma, and I think that's unfortunate. Now, let's also remember that one of the markers of a traditional, one of the values of a traditional diploma from a well-regarded four-year university is a certain measure of acculturation, an indication that one can operate with a certain amount of decorum, can hit deadlines, can walk the walk and talk the talk, right? And for better or worse, that is one of the things that time at a major university indicates to not just prospective employers, but prospective mates and partners and prospective friends and club memberships and so forth like that. So it's not just about one's resume. Through most of American history, you didn't even need a high school diploma to get a good job. We're just at a situation in our economy where we've in fact forced it to degrade to the point where there's this mad rush for credentialism, which doesn't necessarily reflect one's ability to work in the world. And that's a bigger problem that none of us are going to solve. But the one way we should not imagine we're going to solve it is through quick fixes. Now, while there are amazingly great online teachers, I don't consider myself great at it, but I know some who are. Let's be clear, not everybody's good at it. Not every student is good at being an online student. Not every program is designed well. Not every course subject is ideal for that sort of material as well. I mean, I know a lot of online master's degrees that I would consider to be superior to comparable on-site master's degrees, many of which tend to be there just to suck money out of students, unfortunately. And so there are a lot of ways, especially at the master's level, I think we should be celebrating the move to different modes of interaction, and especially when you're dealing with adults who have a lot of other time commitments in their lives. So all of that's really positive, but again, let's not imagine that there is some grand prescription, because even before the invention of the personal computer, universities did not teach just one way. You know, a minority of courses at any particular university are offered in a large lecture format, and that's always been the case. There are labs, there are seminars, there are workshops, there are all sorts of ways, studio programs that have done things, case studies, Socratic methods in the law schools, done things in a very different way. There's no one way of doing higher education, and nor should there be, and the more ways we experiment, the better.
So let me ask you, Jeff, I was just thinking as Siva was speaking about any privacy concerns. I've not seen one of these classes, but can we see the students in the classes? Can we hear their questions or, you know, listen in on some of their dialogue with each other? And are there privacy issues potentially around something like that?
Well, certainly the universities that are signing up with Coursera are very interested in privacy concerns. I mean, there are federal laws protecting students, at least enrolled students, their information. And I think they're getting around that by, trying to obviously carefully guard privacy in some cases, but also, where they can, but also when they have these interactions between the students, I think, are going to opt in to a privacy policy at any of the Coursera or any other group, just like they do when they sign on to Facebook. But I think that's going to be an evolving area of, as students are teaching themselves or working in groups or signing up for these courses, how much they're going to be public about that or and how they're going to, their grades, are they going to be public? And I think a lot of those are among those issues that are still being worked out.
Well, we'll go back to the phones right here in Philadelphia, and we'll welcome Arthur to Radio Times. Hi, Arthur.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I want to first of all just completely support a lot of what Professor Vyasathatham has said, Steva, concerning the idea of the variety of educational experiences. And my question is, goes to this idea of the completeness of college education, and do we want to live in a society, and do we want to have an acceptance of all forms of just taking courses? I mean, there's a kind of vocational, you know, accomplishment and skills accomplishment, but as was pointed out, you know, do we want teachers or nutritionists or people in who are accountants who surround us who have taken courses and not received a kind of credentialization, a kind of validation that is a more generally accepted? I think this works in a kind of, you know, business model. The market will determine it. But I see that as a very dangerous problem in terms of how the idea of consumption becomes the defining aspect of what competency and what efficiency people have. I don't know I want people building my bridges that don't have, and I can't hold accountable, with degrees in engineering. Yeah. So that's kind of my question is, you know, we've been talking about this from the idea of delivery system, but I think the other end is this entire set of questions regarding the efficacy and importance of having a recognition of what degrees mm-hmm. mean. And is this, it plays also against the anti-intellectualism that sort of goes through society at the point, and the idea that a college degree is just a certificate mm-hmm. that says you can do something and not many of the things that were pointed out.
Well, Arthur, thank you for that call. Siva, I'm going to let you take that
one. Well, I think that Arthur's exactly right about many of those concerns. But let's also unpack some of that. There are many thousands of students, maybe millions of students, potential students, who could benefit greatly from a particular skill set picked up through an online delivery system. Maybe it's Coursera-like and MOOC-like. Maybe it's much more focused and developed through a public university or a community college or even University of Phoenix. And you could develop a set of skills. Programming skills, for instance, would be one that might get you an entry-level job. But is that education? It is training. Training and education are not always the same thing. In fact, they're almost never the same thing. So training is good, and education is good. Training is good for some people at some points in their lives, and education is good for other people at other points in their lives. The conflation of the two ideas, I think, is really dangerous. The other thing we need not conflate is the delivery of course information and course content with education, because education is a process. It's something that goes on in fits and starts, successes and failures. It involves a tremendous amount of emotional contact and collaboration with fellow students and with the professor, and some of that can be simulated online, but much of it cannot, right? So you know, I take a tremendous amount of pride in my daily life, in my work life, and in understanding my students as human beings and not necessarily as strings of text on a screen, although when I have to deal with them as strings of text on the screen, I try to remember that they are actually human beings. But as you know, that's not always so easy.
Well, let's see if we can squeeze in one more call. We've only got a couple minutes left, but we'll go to Jamie. Welcome, Jamie, to Radio Times.
Hello. And first, I want to say thank you for a very interesting conversation here. I'm a history professor at a community college in Maryland. I've been teaching online, actually, for quite a while, since the late 1990s, so quite familiar with how it works in a four-credit model at my college. And that's my big question is, how might you adapt this, the MOOC model, for community colleges such as where I teach or state-level colleges, because the focus now is from these elite universities. So I'm just wondering if we have any insight on this.
Well, Jeff, why don't you start off with that one?
Well, a couple of thoughts on that. One is that the edX project out of MIT, Harvard, and now Berkeley, they are a nonprofit group doing these open courses, and they say that they're going to make the platform they're developing, the delivery platform, free and open source so that other colleges, including community colleges, of course, could use it for free. And so it may be that down the line this does become something that community colleges or community college professors can jump onto and do themselves, of course. And then the companies like Coursera that are starting out with these larger companies like Andrew mentioned, or the larger universities, they're also looking into the idea that community colleges could partner with Coursera and maybe offer a course from, say, UVA or Penn on a community college campus that would be giving them credit for there, and maybe even the professors on the ground at those community colleges might have a role in kind of reshaping it or localizing it, from what I understand.
Jeff, what about high school level? Has there been any discussion about maybe, you know, an AP high school course that could be done this way?
You know, I haven't seen that yet. That's an idea that I'm sure Andrew, if he's listening, is writing down on his whiteboard. I think you do look at something like Khan Academy, though, which is another nonprofit effort that's been popular on YouTube, where it's this one person has made thousands of videos now in short 10-minute bursts on different topics, and that one is being used quite a bit at the high school level. And there's talk of designing, I believe, sort of classes around that at high schools, or using those in a flipped classroom method at the high school level.
Well, in our last 60 seconds or so, Siva, I'm going to ask you, what's the best possible outcome for this movement toward online education, these courses that the universities are offering? In your view, what's the best outcome here?
Well, it's a modest outcome, and that is that the university participating in Coursera and other similar efforts managed to spread the word about the really cool things that we do, and enhance to the public the sense of real intellectual engagement and value, like that the stuff we do actually gets across more than our brand name or any sort of illusion that this is going to reduce the cost of education, which of course it won't, and improve economies of scale, which of course there's no reason to believe. So the best thing I could see is that kind of result, along with a diminution of the hyperbole about all of this. I think it's really important to remember one thing as we leave, because we heard from a community college professor. There is no reason to think that a community college professor in Maryland is a better or worse teacher than somebody who teaches history at the University of California, Berkeley. And just because it has the Berkeley brand name on it doesn't mean it's a better experience than what you get at your local community college.
Well, Siva Vaidyanathan, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us here on Radio Times, help us get us some perspective around all of this. Jeff Young, technology editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Jeff, thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here.
And we also want to extend thanks to Andrew Ng, who is now running an online education company called Coursera that offers some of these courses. Our engineer today has been Bob Alls, and our producers are Dennis Devine, Debbie Builder, Susan Greenbaum, and Patty McMahon. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane.